So we are in the middle of the Makos. Seven down, three to go. And Parshas Bo opens with Makah number eight, which is Arbe, which is a locust. And I'd like to take a look at two psukim in the beginning of the Parsha, and we'll see that they're almost identical, which is all the more reason to inspect them closer. And we'll see there is a difference between them. In Perek Yud, Pasuk Yud Beis, Sheni. So Paro and his advisors have been squirming during the Misha Beiruch between the Rishon and Sheni, and now it's time for the Makkah itself. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Nete Yodcha al Eretz Mitzrayim Bo'arbeh. Extend your hand over the land of Mitzrayim for plague with locusts. V'ya'al al Eretz Mitzrayim, they shall ascend over Mitzrayim. V'yochalos kol Esa Ba'aretz, they'll consume, devour all of the produce of the ground. Esa asher hishir habarad, that which the barad left over, after all, we should not forget. This is not the first plague to impact on the crops of Mitzrayim. We've just had barad, and barad rained down the hail and destroyed a great deal, but it left some things over. And it's interesting that Arbe, plague number eight, has almost like a follow-on or supplementary effect to Makkah number seven. Makkah number seven, Barad affected a great deal, and Arbe finishes it off. With the Makkahs don't normally relate to each other in that way. But so be it.
Why did you need two?
And that's essentially what I'm asking. It's the most Jewish of questions. In Pasuk Tesvav, as we see the Torah describe the effect, Pasuk Tesvav reads, Vayichas es ein kol ha'aretz. The Arbe covered the land, Vatechashach ha'aretz, the land was darkened, Vayochal es kol eis ha'aretz, it ate all the crops. Ve'eis kol pri ha'etz asher osir barad, all the fruits of the trees that were left over from the barad, as we saw in Pasuk Yud Beis. So these two psukim, very similar to each other, but there is one key difference, and that is a matter of loshon. For whereas the expression in Pasuk Yud Beis is that it will consume everything asher hishir habarad, that the barad we would translate left over, Pasuk Tesvav reads asher hosir habarad, and again we translate in the same way, that which the barad left over. But the term has changed from hishir to hosir. And the question, of course, is, what's in a word? What's the difference between Hishira Barad, Hosira Barad? They're both leaving over. How many ways are there to leave something over? And here, we entrust ourselves into the hands of one of the great Baalei Haloshon, and that is the Ksava Kabbalah, Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg. And as we know, like the Malbim and like the Vilna Gaon, his forte is going into these what seemingly synonymous terms and explaining the difference in meaning, sometimes atmosphere, between them. And the Ksava Kabbalah says, in fact, there's two ways to leave something over. Derech Moshel. If there's a number of oranges in the bowl and a person takes some and leaves the rest, those that are left over, there's nothing wrong with them. There's nothing inferior about them. He just didn't take everything. That which is left is as good quality as that which was taken, but he just didn't take everything. And some is left over. That's called lehashir. It's left over, but not for lack of quality. However, what would happen if a person has a bowl of oranges and some are good and some are bad? He takes the good and leaves the bad. Those bad quality fruits are left over for a reason, because there's something about them that's why they weren't chosen, or there's something lacking in their quality. That's called lehosir. So nishar means left over, but equal in quality. Nosar means left over, inferior in quality. And he gives us a couple of examples. We find the first time, I believe, what the term Nish'ar is used in the Torah is with regards to Noah. Everyone was killed in the Mabul. Vayisha'er ach Noach v'asheri tova teva. But some were left over, some were spared. Who were spared? Noach and those with him in the teva. But in what way were they left over? Are they inferior quality? To the contrary, they are of superior quality. That's why they were spared the Mabul. That type of being left out is called Nish'ar. And hence the Pasuk says, Vayisha'er ach Noach v'asher ito bateva. The term is Vayisha'er. Similarly, in Parshas Baalosecha, when we have the episode with the 70 men who were chosen for the Sanhedrin, 70 out of 72, each tribe presented 6, and of course 6 times 12 is 72, that's two too many, and there were 2 left over, none other than Eldad and Medad. And the Pasuk there states in Parshas Baalosecha, Vayisha'aru shnei anashim b'machaneh. 2 of them were left over. But why were they left over? Were they inferior in level to the other 70? Not at all. But there's only room for 70, and not for 72, but they were equal in every respect to the other 70. And hence, once again, the term that is used is Vayisha'aru. In contrast, says the Ksav HaKabbalah, sometimes you find the word nosar, and then you get a sense either from the pasuk, or you understand why Chazal said what they said. And that is the forte of the Ksav v'Hakabbalah, explaining the connection between the psukim and the words of Chazal. Lavan has his arrangement with Yaakov, whereby he takes certain sheep, and then he leaves some for Yaakov. The ones that he left for Yaakov were called Estzon Lavon Hanosaros, those that were left over from the ones that Lavon took. That's in Parshas Vayetze. Commenting on that pasuk, Estzon Lavon Hanosaros, the Medrash says, not surprisingly, which ones did Lavon leave for Yaakov? Hacholim Vagruim, those that were sick, those that were weak. I mean, that's what Lavon's idea of fairness, fair trade. But how do Chazal know that they're sick or that they're weak? It just says that they were left over, says the Ksav HaKabbalah, because the Pasuk calls them nosoros. That means they're left over for a reason. They're not as good as the ones that Lavan took. And hence the opening for the words of Chazal. Similarly, a final example before we get back to our parsha, a common phrase when dealing with korbanos, the mincha, as we know, some is taken, that's the kometz, and then some is left over and is consumed by the kohanim. The part of the mincha that's left over is always called, and we're familiar with the phrase, v'hanoseres min ha-mincha, v'hanoseres min ha-mincha. Why is it called noseres? Says the Ksav HaKabbalah, because consider, the fistful, the kometz, is going on the mizbeach. Where is the rest going? To the kohanim. It's not an insult to the Kohanim that they are not on the level of the Mizbeach. And therefore, that distinction in level, the choice goes to the Mizbeach. And that which is relatively on a lower level, or for people that are on a lower level, that's called Noseres Min HaMincha. Well, Achar HaDvarim HaEileh, having established in his way the Ksav HaKabbalah, the difference between the terms Nish'ar and Nosar, what does this have to do with Makas Arbe? Says the Ksav HaKabbalah, look closely at Pasuk Yud Beis and Tesvav, and you will see that they are discussing different things that were left over from the Barad. Pasuk Yud Beis reads, V'yochal eskol esev ha'aretz, it will consume, the Arbe will consume all the crops of the ground, Esa Sher Hish'ir Abarad, that which the Barad left over. That means that the Barad left out some of the crops of the ground. Okay, which crops did the Barad leave out? I mean, presumably it affected everything. But as we know from the end of Parshas Va'era, if we take a look back to the end of Perek Tes, Pasuk Lamed Aleph and Lamed Beis, the Pasuk actually details that some crops were affected and some crops were not affected. Pasuk Lamed Aleph reads, Vapishtava Soron Nukosa. The flax and the barley, they were damaged. And they were wiped out. But Pasuk Lamed Beis, v'achita v'hakusemes lo nuku. The wheat and the spelt, they were not affected at all. They were not impaired at all. Ki afilos heina. The Medrash darshaning on the word afilos says, pile plos. It was a wonder that they're exposed and the Barah didn't touch them. Which means that the crops that were left over from Barah were not affected at all. That being the case, we understand why Pasuk Yud Beis uses the term Eis Asher Hishir HaBarad, because they were left over in a way which doesn't reflect any inferior quality and doesn't leave them any more inferior in the way that they were left over. They're absolutely untouched. That's the Eis of Haaretz, that's the crops of the ground in Pasuk Yud Beis. In contrast to this, in Pasuk Tes Vav, so what is left over there in Pasuk Tes Vav? It says, the ace called Pri Ha'etz, the item that is referred to just before being left over, is Pri Ha'etz, the fruit of the tree. Asher Hosir Abarad, the fruit of the tree that was left over, all the trees were affected, all the trees were hailed upon. It's just not all the fruits were damaged, as if to say. But certainly they were not spared in the sense that they were sectioned off. Everything was hailed on. Anything that was somehow edible was not as good as it was before the hail. And therefore, because they were left over in an inferior state, the term that is used is Hosir Habarat. So this is a classic example of Lashon HaKodesh, two terms, so similar, seemingly. Interchangeable, one might think. Nosar, Nishar, they're two different worlds, two different ways of leaving something over. That's the analysis and explanation of the Ksava Kabbalah. Now, I'd like to move from here to Perek Yud Beis. One of the most difficult aspects of Parshas Bo is that we only have 1 week to talk about it because it is literally packed. But I'd like to take a look at a discussion that tends to take place around Pesach time, but to discuss it in a way that more relates to Parshas Bo than it does to Pesach. If we take a look in Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Kaf Hei, we will find familiar words. Pasuk Kaf Hei, V'hayaki Savo'u El Ha'aret. We're now in Pesach, in Korban Pesach, when you come to the land, Asher Sheyuten Hashem Lachem, Kasher Diber, that Hashem will give you, as he says, Ushmartem Es Avoda Hazos, and you will keep this Avoda, Korban Pesach. V'hayaki Yomru Aleichem Beneichem, Ma Ha'avoda Hazos Lachem. Famous words. Ma Ha'avoda Hazos Lachem. Now, as we know, these words are presented to us in the Haggadah Shel Pesach as the question of the Rasha. We have the four sons, Keneged Arba'a Banim Divrei Torah, and Rasha comes second, and his question is, Ma Ha'avoda Hazos Lachem? And as we know, we take that as a bit of a barbed question, with an inference, Lachem V'lolo, for you and not for him. It's considered to be something of an acerbic nature. And what's the response? Hakei es shinav, knock out his teeth. That will end most conversations. But what exactly does that mean? Hakei es shinav. And moreover, many mefarshim ask, what exactly is the difference between the question of the Rasha and the Chacham? They seem almost identical. The Chacham's question is, Maha'edos, Vachukim, Vamishpatim, Asher Tziva Hashem Elokeinu Eschem. Interestingly, three of the four sons are in our Parsha. That is to say, the Rasha is here, the Tam is towards the end of the Parsha, Mazos, and the Ein Yodea Lishol, Ba'avor Zeh, Asa Hashem Li, Betzeisim Mitzrayim, Bigal Tel Avincha, also the end of Parshas Bo. Three of the four are in Parshas Bo. The Chacham is all the way in Parshas Bo Eschanan, Ma'edus, Vachukim, Vamishpatim. Okay, so we have to be patient to reach the Chacham. But his question seems to be largely similar to the Rasha. He says, Ma'edus, Vachukim, Vamishpatim, Asher Tziva Hashem Elokeinu Eschem, And no one jumps on him and says, oh, do you mean Eschem, you, and not Osi? We don't take it in the same way. What ultimately divides them? And there are many answers to this question. But what's very interesting is that from a certain point of view, to understand the different backgrounds or the different intonations of these questions, you need to see the context in which they are said. And as we quote them in the Haggadah, we don't quote the whole pasuk, we don't quote the whole background, but according to many Mefarshim, it's the background that tips you off as to the difference between them. For if we compare the question of the Rasha, which we just had, which is in Perikah Yudbeis Pasuk Kaf Vav, but then have a look at Perik Yud Gimel towards the end of the parsha, where we'll meet the Tam. Maftir, Perik Yud Gimel, Pasuk Yud Dalet. Many people are looking at Maftir from the beginning of the parsha anyway. V'hayakish alcha bin chaleimor mazos. Your son will say mazos. V'amartoylav v'chozek yad hotzianu Hashem mi Mitzrayim. One of the great gedolim of the 1700s was someone called Rav Raphael HaKohen of Hamburg. And he has a sefer which is entitled Marpe Loshon. And he alerts us to the differences in setting between these two questions. Interestingly, look again in Pasuk Yud Dalet of Perek Yud Gimel. V'haya ki yish alcha bincha mechar leimor mazos. Your son will ask you leimor. Now, what is the meaning of the word leimor? It's a difficult word to translate. We often translate it as saying, but that's not an easy translation because whenever anyone says something, they're saying. So what does the word leimor add? Many Mefarshim explain that leimor is an infinitive. It means to say. But what is the meaning of asking a question to say? But the answer is in Rashi. Because when Moshe davens for Miriam in the end of Va'alosecha, and Moshe speaks to Hashem, Leimor, Kel na Rafanala, Rashi says Leimor means, give me an answer. Respond to me. Leimor, to say, means, I'm asking a question for you to say the answer. That's what it means to ask a question, Leimor. You're asking with the goal that the person will say something. Says Rabbi Raphael HaKohen of Hamburg, and experience bears this out, not every question is asked with the goal that the person will say something back. Sometimes the goal is that the person should have nothing to say back. That's not a question. That's a statement. As if to say, there's two types of questions that can be asked. If you really wish to know, that's called asking leimor, so that the person will speak to you and tell you the answer. But if you feel you know already and you're looking to make a statement, so that's not called leimor. And therefore, the first indicator between these two types of questions, a question asked in innocence is a leimor question. A question asked in a more insidious way, there's no leimor. And indeed, says Rabbi Raphael HaKohen, there is another difference, and the two corroborate each other. When it comes to the tam, what's the verb? V'haya ki yish'alcha bincha leimor. When your son asks you leimor, that's appropriate. Questions are asked. But now go back to the Rasha in Perek Yud Beis Pasuk Tesvav, where it says, V'haya ki yomru aleichem b'neichem. When your children will say to you, Moha avoda hazos lachem. How can you say a question? Isn't a question something that is asked? What does it mean to say a question? Says Rabbi Fall, it depends on the type of question. If the question is a statement, then it's never really asked. It's said. Ki yomru, it's a pronouncement. They're not looking for answers. They're looking to make a statement. That's the type of question that is said. And therefore, we already know that there's an agenda behind this question. And moreover, says Rabbi Father, the closer you look at these psukim, the more you see. How many Jews does it take to ask a question? I mean, the answer is all of them, but how many at once? Once again, there's a difference between the two psukim. Pasuk Yudalet, Vayak Yishalcha Bincha Leimor. It's Beloshon Yachid. It's in the singular. Your son has a question. He can ask. It doesn't take more than one person to ask. But go back to Perek Yud Beis, the question of the Rasha, and there you will find Vaya ki yomru aleichem beneichem. Your sons will ask, where do they all come from? And why are they all here? And why are they all asking? Says Rabbi Fahl, a question that is intended to make a statement tends to be asked in company, in groups, because the more people asking, the more emphatic is the statement. And therefore, as soon as there's a number of people there, that already should raise suspicions. It turns out that if we look at the nusach of the question itself, maybe you can't tell that much between them. But look at how the Torah presents them. Ki yomru versus yishalcha. Many versus one. Leimor versus lack of leimor. You get the measure of the question. And that means that the response to the first response to the Rasha is to understand that his question is not really a question. And this brings us to hake eschinav, knock through his teeth. The teeth represent expression. In fact, to express something is called vishinantam, from the word shame. Hake eschinav means, if you take the question of the Rasha at face value, you're wasting everyone's time because he's not interested in your answer. Hakeyes Shinov, you need to break through the external expression of a question and deal with it for what it is, and that's a statement. A question deserves an answer. A statement deserves a counter statement. And that's why, in response to the Rasha, we say, Ba'avurzeh asar shemli b'teisi mimitzrayim, which is a counter statement. He said, Lachem v'lo lo, for you and not for me. And we say li velolo, for me and not for him. That's the only language that one can respond to a statement with a statement in kind.
Excuse me, the Torah gives it an answer.
Correct.
And
yes, 100%.
What's the answer to the Torah?
Zebach Pesach, but that's not to him. Va'amartem Zebach Pesach.
Yes, so that's the answer.
It doesn't say va'amartem elav. Zebach Pesach is not necessary.
Yeah, I know, but that's the answer the Torah gives.
Correct. Good. So this leads us to a final question. And that is, what about the Eino Yodea Lishol? Many people feel that he gets a bit of a rough part of the bargain. Because we say to him, V'gadata levincha b'avurzeh asa shem li b'tzeisi mimitzrayim, which is essentially the same answer that the Baal Haggadah presents to the Rasha. That seems to be quite harsh, to put him in such a criminal company. After all, he didn't do anything wrong. In fact, he didn't do anything at all. He's Eino Yodea Lishol, and we seem to confront him and give him the same answer that we gave to the Rasha. To both of them we say, Ba'avurzeh asa Hashem li b'tzeisi mimitzrayim, leave alone, lo, me and not him, and also not him. That's a little harsh. So this question is addressed by one of the great Talmidim of Reb Chaim Volozhin, Reb David Tevel, in his drushas. And Reb David Tevel says a wonderful thing. The truth of the matter is, says Reb David Tevel, you can say the same exact words to the Rasha and the Ein Yodea Lishol, and each of them receives exactly the answer that he needs. Why? How does this work? Says Reb David Tevel, very simply. Why is this the appropriate response for the Rasha? Because there's an inference. When you say Ba'avurzeh asa Hashem li, li velo lo, you answer him in kind. So the barb in the answer, or the harsh element within the answer, comes from an inference. Says of David Tevel, the Ein Yodea Lishol is not in the inference business. If he doesn't know how to ask a question, he certainly doesn't know how to make an inference. Which means you can address both of them with the same question and each one will hear it on a different level. The Rasha is also shtikel chacham. If he wasn't that smart, he couldn't really be a Rasha. And therefore he understands an inference when he hears one. The Ein Yodea Lishol doesn't understand an inference even if it's staring him in the face. And therefore you say the same words, Bavozeh asah Hashem li b'mitzeisi b'mitzrayim, and the Ein Yodeh L'Shol hears that, and he just hears Dvarim kipshutam, and he's happy. The Rasha hears more. He hears li v'lo lo. So this is, again, it's a side of the four sons that we don't often get to when we're in the four sons, because it really comes from the psukim that surround. So these are some comments with regards to that matter. Now I'd like to move from here to discuss one of the central aspects of the Parsha, and that is the Korban Pesach. As we know, the Korban Pesach, on the one hand, it's a korban like other korbanos, and it has halachas of korbanos like others, but in many respects, it's unique. It comes into its own. It has halachas that pertain only to it, and they are outlined in our pasuk. For example, it can only be eaten in one place. Bebayis echad yeyachel. You cannot take it out from where it started. There is no concept, similar concept with other korbanos. Unique to Korban Pesach. Secondly, it can only be prepared roasted. It's the most unusual thing. Every other korban can be prepared cooked or roasted, however. But the Korban Pesach can only be roasted. Indeed, according to the Mishnah, in the times of the Korban Pesach, this is one of the questions of the Manishtana. Shebechol aleilo, sonu ochlin, we eat basar, tzali, shaluk, mevushal, it can be casserole, it can be cooked, it can be roasted. Halayla azeh, kulo tzali. Tonight, it's got to be roasted. One of the questions of the Manishtana. So the Korban Pesach has unique halachas that pertain to it, to the degree that moves us to ask, at the risk of borrowing a well-known expression, Manishtana korban azeh, mikol korbanos. Now, if we go back to the roots of the exile in Egypt, and they are rooted as far back as Avram Avinu, he is told in Bereishis, Perek Tesvav, Parshas Lech Lecha, Yodoa Teda, Ki Ger Yezarecha Be'eretz Lo Lahem, they'll be strangers there, Va'avodim Ve'inu Osam, they'll serve them, they'll persecute them, Arba Me'o Shana. Which means that, looked at simply, the events that we read about in Shemos and Va'era and Bo are all manifestations and fulfillments of what we call the Bris Bein HaBesarim told to Avram Avinu. However, we find a statement in the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos on Daf Yud which seems to provide an alternative tributary, an alternative cause for our experiences in Mitzrayim. The Gemara there looks at the Kasonis Pasim, at Yosef's coat, and says, over this coat, we all went down to Egypt. Nisgalgalu hadavar v'yardu avoseinu l'mitzrayim. As if to say, the Gemara seems to be implementing the situation between Yosef and the brothers as a cause for Golus Mitzrayim. In other words, we know that historically, or chronologically, or sequentially, the episode with the brothers is what precipitated us going down to Mitzrayim. That doesn't necessarily mean that it is an essential cause. However, the Gemara seems to say that it is, because you see, over that tension, that bad feeling, which is all embodied and represented in the Ksonas Pasim, the Gemara says, that's what brought us down to Mitzrayim. Indeed, as we've mentioned on a number of occasions, according to one of the great commentators on the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, Rabbeinu Manoach, this is what is behind the minhag, or the part of the Seder, which we call Karpas, just before Magid. Karpas almost defies interpretation. It's not the name of a vegetable. And what does the word Karpas mean? Actually, the word Karpas is a word in Tanakh in a way that doesn't seem to help us at all, because it's in Megillas Esther. In the very beginning, Achashverosh is having his feast, and one of the tapestries there, Chur Karpas Utcheles. There's many customs when it comes to karpas. I've yet to hear wool tapestries listed among them. So, but how is it connected? However, Rashi in Parshas Vayeshev explains that the kesonis pasim, the name for the coat, and pasim some say means striped or multicolored, and there's many different interpretations of what is kesonis pasim. But Rashi explains that the word pasim refers to the material of the coat, fine wool, as it says, Rashi quoting Megillah, karpas utcheles, which means that karpas as a type of wool is relevant to the story because the ksones pasim was of that type of quality of wool. And therefore, says Rabbeinu Manoach, as we begin the story, and we know on Seder night you have to begin at the beginning. And when does the story begin? Avodim Hayinu. But how did we get there? Every chapter one deserves a prologue. So how did we get to chapter one? How did we get to Mitzrayim? The answer is Yosef's coat and the surrounding dynamics. And that's why we take a vegetable, we call it karpas, because it's a zecher to the ksonas pasim, and we dip it in vinegar or salt water as a zecher for the dipping of Yosef's coat, which the brothers did. That's karpas, that's how it begins. Now, the problem is, of course, how do we reconcile these two approaches or these two presentations as to what led us down to Mitzrayim? If you look in Parshas Lech Lecha, apparently it's all foretold to Avram. That's all you need. You don't need anything else to bring it about. But the Gemara seems to implicate the episode with Yosef as that which brought it about. Well, many Mefarshim explain that essentially these were two corroborative causes. And what that means is, and we've mentioned this not too long ago, HaKadosh Baruch Hu never mentions Mitzrayim. He never says where, and Mitzrayim is the worst place to be in Golos, which means that in terms of what was foretold to Avram, it could have played itself out in another location, perhaps in a different way. Mitzrayim is the worst place to be. And therefore, what aggravated the situation? And what was it that determined that of all places to be in exile, it would be in Mitzrayim specifically? That's the additional element of the episode with Yosef and the brothers. Now, as we can appreciate, it is perhaps oversimplistic to say that our experiences in Mitzrayim were, shall we say, punishment for the sale of Yosef. It can't be that simple, for a very basic reason. Yosef's descendants also suffered in Mitzrayim. But he's the victim. He was sold. If it's all comeuppance for the sale of Yosef, so Yosef said they should have been spared, which they were not. And what about Binyamin? Binyamin's not involved in any capacity in the sale, but Binyamin is also... But rather, even the sale of Yosef is indicative of a certain lack of unity, a certain fragmentation that existed apparently amongst all the brothers to some degree, which means that everyone needed to go through Mitzrayim. The question is, how does Mitzrayim deal with any of this? But this brings us to a fascinating element within Golas Mitzrayim. As if to say, one of the byproducts, or one of the consequences of the way the Jewish people were dealt with in Egypt, is it brought them all closer together. And this remains true very often when everything is fine and there's no common enemy or common threat or common oppressor. It's the Jews amongst themselves. They begin to find differences between them and pounce on them and exacerbate them. But those tend to disappear. Because when Paro is targeting everyone, so then everyone finds much more in common with each other. And this was a very, albeit harsh way of, in a sense, healing what would seem to be a fissure within the unity of the Jewish people in that formative time, which had it not been treated at that early stage, who knows where it could have gone. And that is a very interesting element within Golas Mitzrayim, to understand that it is looking to foster unity amongst the Jewish people and somehow deal with what had come out in the sale of Yosef. And all of this brings us to the Korban Pesach. What is behind the Korban Pesach? And it's fascinating, just before we get to the Korban itself, just to quote one line from the Medrash, which also we see from Chazal themselves, that they see a connection between the events with Yosef and the brothers and our experiences in Mitzrayim. There is a collection of Midrashim on Tehillim, Medrash Shocher Tov, it's called, and Medrash Tehillim in Perek Yud, so one line which says, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lashvatim, Hashem says to the tribes, Atem Amartem Le'eved Nimkar Yosef, you said, or you saw to it, that Yosef would be sold as a slave. Chayechem, by your lives. Atem korim atzmechem b'kol shana v'shana avodim hayinu. You will every year recall how you were also slaves. In other words, and the Medrash has a very unique way of expressing it, but an aspect at least of avodim hayinu is because le'eved nimkar Yosef. Now, what's behind the Korban Pesach as far as we can tell? The primary element, and the way that it's normally discussed, is that it's about distancing the Jewish people from Avodah Zarah. After all, the lamb was something that was typically worshipped. It's representative of the constellation of Taurus. That's how the Ramban explains. And therefore, the statement that's being made is one of distancing oneself from Avodah Zarah. And therefore they took the deity of the Egyptians, they slaughtered it in front of them, and that's Shabbos HaGadol, and that was a great event, and then they offer it as a korban. However, as we will see, there is another element. Let us take a look at Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Kaf Aleph. And this is a very interesting section here, because in the earlier psukim, shall we say, the first 20 or so psukim of Perek Yud Beis, is the Torah describing Hashem's instructions to Moshe. From Pasuk Kaf Aleph, and the next few psukim, is Moshe relaying instructions to Bnei Yisrael. Some of those instructions were not in the first, were not in the earlier psukim. All of it together comes as Hashem's command to Bnei Yisrael. Pasuk Kaf Aleph. Vayikra Moshe lechol ziknei Yisrael. Moshe calls all the elders, vayomer aleihem, and says to them, Mishchu, Mem Shin Kaf Vav. Mishchu, draw. We will have to come back to that word. Mishchu ukechu lachem tzom lemishpachoseichem v'shachatu haposach. And acquire for yourselves, obtain for yourselves, for your families, flock, and shecht the Pesach. What is the word mishchu? It is not an easy word to translate, because what exactly are you drawing? Rashi comments that if you own a sheep, so draw it close. And if not, you'll have to buy one. So mishchu ukichu are two alternatives, depending on whether you own one or not. The Medrash has the astounding comment that mishku actually means to withdraw your hand. Moshech yadayim. Withdraw your hand from what? From Avodah Zarah. That's what the Mechilta says. It brings in here the very difficult fact that the Jewish people, as the Navi tells us in Yechezkel, were to an extent involved in Avodah Zarah themselves. And Moshe says, that has to stop, and it will stop here. Mishchu yedeichem mi'avodah zarah ad kedei kach. But Rabbeinu Bachya has a fascinating comment. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, the word mishchu, and here we see from the Rishonim that there are certain, one could say, resonant words, the associative words. When you hear the word mishchu, which seems to be extraneous, you've got to look back. What is this associated with? Well, says Rabbeinu Bachya, how did they sell Yosef? Vayimshechu vayalu es Yosef min habor. They drew him up from the pit. And therefore, says Rabbeinu Bachya, the Korban Pesach, an element within it is to correct the earlier Vayimshechu with this Mishchu. That means that whatever went wrong with the sale of Yosef is also now being corrected with the Korban Pesach. That's the Mishchu. You've got to draw up something right. And that's why, once again, we find an element, and as we know, some of the aspects of Korban Pesach are unique to that first Pesach, and some of them remain for all generations. One of them that's unique for that Pesach, in Perek Kaf Bey, Apostle Kaf Bey's, Ulekachtem Agudas Ezov, take for yourself a bundle of Ezov, of Hyssop, Utevaltem Badam Asher Basaf, and dip it in blood. And there again, says Rabbeinu Bachya, we have this idea that as part of the avoda for that year of the Korban Pesach is you take something, you dip it in blood. The last thing that we saw dipped in blood was Yosef's coat. And it's back again. But here is part of a mitzvah. And what's interesting is two things. What is dipped in blood? Agudas Ezov. And what is an aguda? An aguda is something that is grouped together. As if to say, the grouping together of the, in this case, the Ezov, that item, means that the lesson that needs to be learned is that of grouping together, to be an aguda. And interestingly, how did the Jewish people become an aguda? What's their role model for cohesion? The answer is Ezov. Hyssop. Ezov, as Rashi will tell us in Parshas Metzora, is a symbol of humility. It's low. As long as everyone is at their full height and with their full ego, very difficult to group together because you're never really together. Everyone's equal, but everyone wants to be more equal than everyone else. And then things get in the way, as if to say, Moshe is almost saying, learn from the Ezov. The things that bother us are not really that important. If you can put them to the side, there's nothing that stops the Jewish people from getting together. And that's really what the Golus was meant to do for them, in part. And what this Korban is meant to represent. And that's why it is eaten. L'mishpachoseichem. In your families. Because it comes as an antidote to the original fracture that took place within the family of Israel by the sale of Yosef. And what's fascinating is here it takes place, it's eaten together. It's a meal of togetherness. The last significant meal that we see in Parshas, in Chumash Bereishis, is the meal that the brothers had after they sold Yosef. What they sold, and then Vayeshvu Lechol Lechem. But that was a meal of exclusion, because it was to seal the fact that they'd gotten rid of Yosef. And that needs to be countered now with a meal that is fully L'mishpachoseichem. And this will explain to us why the Korban Pesach has other unique features, and some of them are even ledoros. It can only be eaten in one place. There's no fragmenting. There's no factionalizing. There's no we'll be here and we'll be here. Wherever it started, that's where it stays. Bebayis echad yeyachel. And moreover, there is a fascinating comment of the Maharal in the Sefer Gevuras Hashem, who discusses why it is that of all ways of the Korban to be prepared, it's specifically roasted. There's many ways. So what's unique about roasting? Says Maharal, unlike every other type of preparation, if you prepare something, meat or anything, with liquid, it tends to loosen the food and makes it softer. And in a sense, The particles, their connection with each other is somewhat looser. You take meat and you cook it, and then it gets softer. The more you roast something, the closer together all of those particles come. and therefore roasting is an achdus way of preparing something. Ad kedei kach. So it comes down to the way that it's eaten, the way that it's prepared. All of these things promote the oneness that the Jewish people need to be aspiring to. This matter is discussed in a sefer called Chikrei Lev, which was authored by or comes from the Torah of Reb Lev Hyman Zatzal, who was the Rav of the Groshul in Bayit Vegan. And he adds a fascinating PS. As we know, when Hashem first appears to Moshe and charges him with going to deliver Bnei Yisrael, Moshe refuses. And that's quite something to do. And he refuses over a period of a number of days, according to Rashi. I mean, it takes stamina and more. And at a certain point, one of the reasons why Moshe does not wish to go is because he feels that Aaron should be the one. And that's something that we find in Perek Dalet. In Parsha Shemos, he says, Shlachna b'yad tishlach. Please send Aaron, don't send me. And there we discover that part of what is holding Moshe back is that he feels that Aaron should be the one. Now, it still needs to be understood because HaKadosh Baruch Hu clearly has decided otherwise. I mean, what exactly is behind, if we may ask, behind Moshe's resistance here? And he doesn't abate, and he doesn't rest easy until Hashem says, Aaron will see you, v'ro'acha v'somach b'libo. He'll be happy for you. You won't upset him. Which really says volumes about Aaron, because Moshe now goes down as the quintessential leader, took the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim, and it could have been Aaron. And Moshe feels it should be Aaron. And moreover, the Jewish people feel that it should be Aaron. That's part of Moshe's fear, concern, that the Jewish people won't believe him, that Hashem appeared to him, because Moshe has been away for such a long time. And Aaron has been with them all this time. And we know from the Navi Yechezkel from the Navi Shmuel, Hashem had already appeared to Aaron. Aaron prophesied before Moshe prophesied. So he is his senior in years. He is his senior in prophecy, prophesying before. He's been with the Jewish people all through this time, and it was a great shock that it's actually Moshe. We need to consider the fact, I mean, Moshe, that there's differing opinions as to how long exactly he was away for. But it could be anything up to 60 years. That means anyone who is less than 60 plus years old, when they hear that Moshe is the one who's going to redeem them, will probably ask, Moshe who? Because they've never seen him, and they may never have heard of him. And all of a sudden he comes in, and then it's Moshe. And Aaron is attached to Moshe to help him. This is outstanding, and should be noted as such. On the one hand, the Moshe and Aaron, they're light years above us, and we feel like it's meaningless to talk about their madriga, but it's not true. Because to be joyous, to be happy for that Moshe is the one who's receiving all this greatness, that's something that should be noted and emulated, if possible. The question is, what's behind, again, this resistance, as we've seen? Perhaps it should be Aaron. But Rav Hyman says, once we appreciate that redemption from Egypt means the Jewish people are finally healed, fundamentally, in the sense that they finally are cohesive again, and ill will between people has been removed, ill will between brothers has been removed, Moshe considers it to be antithetical in the extreme. If the deliverance from Mitzrayim will be on the cheshbon of one of the brothers feeling bad for something that one of the other brothers did, that's reopening what the whole Golus experience was meant to be closing, was meant to be sealing. And therefore Moshe is saying, how can it be? We've been in Mitzrayim all this time to make sure that brothers are no one feels that they've been put out. And on the way to deliver them, I'll do that to Aaron. I mean, that's the very issue that we've been trying to treat. That will get trampled on along the way. That's what's behind the strong feelings of Moshe. At Kerekaf, did he resist when Hashem tells him to go? And it isn't until Hashem says, V'roch av asomach b'libo, on the contrary, there will be no bad feeling. Aaron will be happy for you. And then Moshe relents. And then there's no looking back. So this is a fascinating element within the whole of Golas Mitzrayim, really, and certainly within the Korban Pesach. And what's interesting is just to consider in conclusion how these two aspects within the Korban Pesach intersect, or how they align with each other. As if to say, on the one hand, you have this idea within Korban Pesach, it's a rejection and a repudiation of Avodah Zarah, this is the deity of the Egyptians, and we're not having it, and we slaughter it, and it's all about Avodah Zarah, which is very Ben Adam Lamako. On the other hand, you have these elements and aspects within the Korban Pesach that are, we could say, very Ben Adam Lachavera. They're about unity, and they're about cohesion, and they're about family, and so apparently it's like a dual korban. It has a dual purpose. But it's important to realize that at the end of the day, these two are not as distinct as we might think. And it's no surprise that if these are the two branches of Torah living and of what we call Judaism, that in the end they have a symbiotic relationship with each other. They are mutually dependent on each other. And the reason why is because the full connection, if we understand that Avodah Zarah is really disconnects a person from Hashem and he throws his lot in with something else, but a rejection of that is that he's looking to connect absolutely with Hashem. The only entity that can fully connect with Hashem absolutely is the entity called the Jewish people. An individual amongst the Jewish people, if they're fragmented, the Shekhinah, the divine presence, will not be connected to them in the same way. Rabbi Isaac Chover, again, one of the Talmidim from the Beis HaMedrash of the Gra, he gives a mashal, and it's such a poignant way of expressing it. One could almost say, Lahavdil, but one could almost say that Hashem is like, he's the soul of the Jewish people. He is the ultimate spiritual force, and the Jewish people are connected, and he's that which gives them life. Says Rabbi Isaac Chover, a soul doesn't reside in a body that's fragmented. You've got a body in 1,000 pieces. So where's the soul going to go? And in the same way, as long as the Jewish people are not one, so they're not fully connected with Hashem himself. And that's why we say, Ata echad, v'shimcha echad, u'mika amcha Yisrael goy echad ba'aretz. And we normally translate that on a basic level, you are one, your name is one, the Jewish people are one, but the point is, they are Amcha Yisrael when they are Goy Echad, when they're one like you are one. And again, to the extent that one can say that, as if to say Hashem is one and no more. When the Jewish people are one and no more, that's when they're called Amcha Yisrael. And in fact, Rabbi Zakhover, we mentioned in the past, goes so far as to say that there was a long time that Yaakov went without receiving any message from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then it came back to him when he heard that Yosef was alive. V'atechi ruach Yaakov avihem. And as we know, and the common understanding is, that as long as he was in mourning for Yosef, so he's sad. And when a person is not in a state of joy, so then they can't receive the Shekhinah. And when he heard the news that Yosef is alive, so that's the first time that he returned to a joyous state again, and then Hashem appears to him. It's all about his state. Is he happy? Is he sad? That's how Rashi explains. But Rabbi Isaac Chover says there's another element here. Yaakov could not receive a message from Hashem all those years because the Jewish people were fragmented. That's why. if we say that Hashem only has that special connection with the Jewish people when they're one, and prophecy is an expression of that connection, it was not a possibility as long as the Jewish people of that time were in pieces, which they were, because one brother had been sold out. And that's why Yaakov, and we don't know on what level Yaakov knows what's happening with Yosef, but one thing's for sure, Yosef isn't here, and the reality is that there is bad feeling. And things are not as they should be, and it's a lack of shlemus, of cohesion and unity amongst what was then the Jewish people, and that's why Ruach HaKodesh was denied from Yaakov. When does it come back? When Yosef is alive, and things are healing, and they've begun to mend the rift, and when the Jewish people get themselves back together again, HaKodesh Baruch Hu comes back together to them, and Yaakov once again enjoys the experience of Nevuah and of Ruach HaKodesh. These are things that we say about Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's a long time ago, but as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Galus Mitzrayim and Yetzias Mitzrayim are the root exile and redemption experiences for the Jewish people. Ve'ele Shemos B'nei Yisrael, Haboim Mitzrayima, as the Mefarshim say, Bale HaRemez, Boim is Bavel, Edom, Yavon, Madai, all of the future exiles are encapsulated within this, which means that as we seek very earnestly to find a way out of our exile, we do well to look back at how we got out of the original exile. And the answer is twofold, but it's really one answer, and that is to reestablish our connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that comes hand in hand and is empowered with reestablishing our connection with each other, and with that we're able to come back together as one, and Hashem Echad draw close to us again. Ki me tseinu me eret Mitzrayim yarenu niflos. That's what the pasuk says, talking to the Jewish people. Ki me tseinu me eret Mitzrayim yarenu niflos. I'll show him wonders as I did when we came out of Mitzrayim, because the goal is that it should happen in the same way. The trail has been set, and Mitzvah Hashem, as we follow, it should lead us towards the redemption that we wait for, which will come b'mehirah b'yamin.